brilliance of the name, Juneteenth. What better name for a June 19th could there possibly be? That's great. It's fetching. You know, it's catchy.
As with all catchy names, Gates says there is also a bit of fiction around that day in 1865 when Gordon Granger issued General Order No. 3 to free the enslaved black people of Galveston, Texas, 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation.
Well, we were raised to think that Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, right? The problem is that the Emancipation Proclamation in and of itself didn't have the power to free anybody. It only applied to enslaved people in the Confederacy, and it can only be enforced if Union troops had captured territory in the South, in the Confederacy. Only about 500,000 enslaved men and women, we think, actually got their freedom from the Emancipation Proclamation. And James, there were 3.9 million enslaved African Americans, so the overwhelming majority of our ancestors were not freed by the Emancipation Proclamation.
So the significance then of General Gordon Granger going to Galveston?
We all think that the Civil War ended when Lee surrendered to Grant at Appomattox, which was April 9, 1865. But that's not true. There were several different Confederate armies. So Texas finally surrenders to the Union on June 2nd. Gordon Granger comes, and on June 19th in Galveston, he issues the Emancipation Proclamation because now the Union Army is in possession of the territory. So that's the true story.
And what about the notion that enslaved black people in Texas did not know they were free?
One of the myths about Juneteenth is that nobody in Texas had heard about it. But there are two reasons that many historians think that black people knew about the Emancipation Proclamation, too. One is because of the proverbial grapevine. So there was this miraculous way for enslaved people to communicate plantation to plantation and state to state. But the second factor is that because Texas was removed from the main action of the Civil War, many slaveholders moved to Texas for safety, and they took their enslaved people with them. Those enslaved people would have known about the Emancipation Proclamation by and large, and would have told other enslaved people. But no one could enforce it because the Union did not capture territory then.
When I came here, I dedicated this tree in honor of my mother and father.
Professor Gates says the most important thing about Juneteenth is the era that came after.
The most radical thing that happened after the end of the Civil War for the rights of our enslaved ancestors were the ratification of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And the Reconstruction Acts. This was the first concentration of black power. In the summer of 1867, 80% of all eligible black men who were formerly enslaved in the South registered to vote. And in 1868, they actually voted. Ulysses S. Grant won the presidency. So you could reasonably say that black men had elected a president of the United States.
Back in Galveston, Texas, the formerly enslaved began marking their freedom with the celebration 1 year later in 1866 and have been celebrating Juneteenth ever since. As far as Professor Gates is concerned, the details of Juneteenth are less important than the power of its message.
There's a kind of poetic magic in that story, a kind of comfort, a kind of retribution, a kind of belated administering of justice that appeals to all of us. Juneteenth is one of the first holidays that black people created on their own. And of the holidays that they created in slavery times, Juneteenth is the one that survived and is now a national holiday.
Isn't it important for all Americans to understand that Juneteenth ought to be embraced by all Americans?
For a country built upon the love of freedom, any manifestation of the enjoyment of freedom should be celebrated by all our countrymen. Let's hope for that day.
In Cambridge, Massachusetts, James Brown, CBS News.
Thanks for listening. Peace.
I just got a text asking me to approve a bank transfer I didn't make. I bet you get messages like this too. So much of our lives are online today, from email to banking and everything in between. To make sure my information was protected, I checked out CISA's Secure Our World website for simple steps to stay safe online. Now I know how to protect myself from scammers, and you can learn too. Go to CISA at CISA.gov/Secure Our World. I just got a text asking me to approve a bank transfer I didn't make. I bet you get messages like this too. So much of our lives are online today, from email to banking and everything in between. To make sure my information was protected, I checked out CISA's Secure Our World website for simple steps to stay safe online. Now I know how to protect myself from scammers, and you can learn too. Go to CISA at CISA.gov/Secure Our World.
I've got a message. 나 지금 심심해란 말이고 왜 손이 바빠 대화가 끊기지 않게 oh, babe. 만족하고 싶은 너에게 가로 세로처럼 취향을 말해줘 널 알아가게 마음과 마음이 닿게 손과 손이 닿게 쉬다가도 되는 나의 품에 걸어갔던 내 맘이 조금 답답하지만 참는 자기의 복이 있잖아 댄스를 시작해 서로에 대한 얘기 어쩌면 어찌란 얘기들까지도 모든 길은 열어둬 선은 지원해줘 직구적은 뭐 어때 이대로 좋잖아 오늘 이 옆자리 나 널 웃게 해줄 사람 나 조금씩 마음을 풀어놔도 돼 알고 싶어져 알고 싶어져 너의 모든 게 다 사소하더라도 사소하더라도 알려줘 네 모든 걸 Action. 오늘 네 옆자리 나 널 웃게 해줄 사람 나 기분 네가 좋아 나 모든 게 난
Hello everyone, welcome to Ebony Spectrum for this week. This is Kevin Amos, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. We have several things to go over with you this week on Ebony Spectrum as we talk about several different topics. We'll talk about Trump and the black voters, we'll talk about Juneteenth, and we'll talk about the Tulsa Massacre Survivor Reparations. So stay with us. And we would like to remind you that the opinions expressed by the different commentators are not those opinions expressed of WRCT or Rick and myself. Thank you.
But we begin tonight with manufacturing consent, a concept introduced by Edward S. Herman and Noam Chomsky in their 1988 book on the political economy of the mass media. Here's a clip from the 1992 documentary of the same name.
But when the state loses the bludgeon, when you can't control people by force, and when the voice of the people can be heard, you have this problem. It may make people so curious and so arrogant that they don't have the humility to submit to a civil rule, and therefore you have to control what people think.
In short, it is the job of the media, our job, to not just tell you what happened, but to give you some context around what happened in a way that informs you and helps you make decisions in your busy life. But too often, what the media actually does is create a mass consensus around the preferences of the financial and moneyed elite to subtly make their preferences your preferences. This is especially true in selling wars and sometimes elections. In the November election to come, which, let's just be honest, could be our last free and fair election due to the machinations of a certain political religious cult, the wealthiest Americans have a clear preference for the outcome. Donald Trump reinstalled as president. Mother Jones recently reported the following in an article about America's top donors heavily favoring Trump and the Republicans, which reflects something we've long known about rich conservatives, their disdain for taxation. Mother Jones reports that Donald Trump may have lost in the Manhattan court, where a jury convicted him of all 34 felony charges of falsifying business records. But, quote, there's one place he and his party appear to be winning, in the race to snag major cash from the richest families in America. For all of Trump's supposed grassroots appeal, as of May 1st, less than one-third of contributions to his campaign committee for the 2024 election cycle had come from grassroots donors. That means people giving less than $200. According to Open Secrets, large contributors accounted for 69% of Trump's $121 million total, whereas President Biden's campaign committee, which took in $195 million, got 54% from large donors. More broadly, the lion's share of confirmed contributions from the biggest political givers, the top 100 families, have flowed to Republican candidates and groups. Then there's something called hard money. This is the money contributed directly to a specific candidate, and these are donations that the federal government caps. In the hard money category, Mother Jones reports that Republicans took in 27% more from the top 100 families than Democrats did. In dollar terms, that's about $86 million for the Republicans versus about $68 million for the Democrats. But if you include soft money, the unlimited donations that the Supreme Court made possible through their Citizens United ruling during and maybe in response to President Obama getting elected by a 10 million vote margin, it's not even close. Quoting Mother Jones again, Republicans raked in a whopping $508 million from the top 100, triple the Democrats' $169 million take. It's a lot of numbers and data, but it may leave you wondering, why would America's wealthiest families continue pouring money into a political party that has stripped itself of its dignity to fashion itself into a religious cult centered around a 78-year-old 37-count felon and adjudicated sexual abuser? Well, Michael Mechanic of Mother Jones, who authored the piece that I'm quoting from, has a pretty good guess. Biden and the Dems have spooked America's richest with their multiple and largely unsuccessful efforts to close abusive loopholes and raise taxes on corporations and the upper crust. That includes efforts to tax the unrealized gains of the mega rich. The paper profits on appreciated investments that are currently only taxed when the assets are sold. In the meantime, Trump and the Republicans are fighting to extend their unpopular and ultimately disappointing 2017 tax cuts, a move the Congressional Budget Office calculates will cost the U.S. government $3.5 trillion with a T over 10 years. So what does that have to do with manufacturing consent? Well, it probably wouldn't go over too well if you, gentle viewer, understood that setting Trump up as an autocrat is merely the price that the super rich are willing to make you pay, just to stuff more tax cut cash into their already deep pockets. Much better to make you believe that the people who really want Trump back in charge are closer to home. Which brings me to Father's Day. Happy Father's Day to all the great dads out there. Now, if you're a practicing Christian, a lot of you saints may have spent at least part of yesterday in church, celebrating your dads and, of course, the Heavenly Father. And in America, that tends to be a, shall we say, highly segregated experience. No one seems to know who originated the quote, but it's been repeated by everyone from James Baldwin, who said he was quoting Malcolm X, to Dr. King, that the most segregated hour in American life is 11 a.m. on a Sunday. It's just a factual legacy of this nation's history with race and religion that there are predominantly white churches and there are black churches. But what do you think of when you think of a black church? Probably something like this. Now, you may even think of images such as these, but what you probably don't think of is this.
What a nice welcome. Thank you.
That is the reaction to Donald Trump at what nearly every major media outlet reported was his visit to a black church in Detroit, Michigan, one of the 10 blackest cities in America, with a population that's about 78% African-American and a poverty rate topping 33%. In other words, it would be hard not to fill a Detroit church with black people. So now I want you to look with your eyes. Just look with your eyes again at this crowd. Is what you're seeing here, what you would write in a headline, is a black church? And yet, here was the headline in the New York Times: Trump, in pitch to black voters in Detroit, cast Biden as anti-black. And the Washington Post: Trump portrays rampant crime in speech at black church in Detroit. And the Associated Press: Trump blasts immigrants for taking jobs as he courts voters at a black church MAGA event in Detroit. The Detroit Free Press even ran a photo series online with the headline: Trump visits Detroit church to woo black voters. What they somehow forgot to show was how overwhelmingly white that crowd was, and also how many empty seats there were in that sanctuary. In fact, if you looked at the carefully selected images in their online story, you would probably guess the crowd inside that sanctuary was overwhelmingly black and pro-Trump, literally cheering for him and chanting his name. And you would be forgiven for believing that this reinforces what seems to be the new hot narrative, that it is black people, specifically black men, who are driving Trump back into the White House with their overwhelming and historically growing support. When the actual reality that you can see with your own eyes and know if you peel back the layers just a little bit is that Trump spoke to an overwhelmingly white crowd inside a large Detroit church that, yes, does indeed have a black pastor, but which merely served as a venue. And that the people who participated in the roundtable, like those in the audience at that church, were already Trump supporters, not some new historic black supporters of Trump. Trump was in Detroit to participate in something called the People's Convention, a weekend-long gathering arranged by Turning Point Action, a conservative grassroots group founded by activist Charlie Kirk. It would have been easy enough to ask some of the attendees at that roundtable if they came to that church from the convention. And while several of these stories note that Trump harped on crime as part of his presentation, doesn't it seem kind of ironic and pretty relevant that the guy saying that just recently got convicted of 34 felony counts in New York? I mean, Trump raised the crime rate in Detroit just by being there. And one of his new friends at that event, Kwame Kilpatrick, Detroit's former mayor, is just 4 years out of prison himself, where he was sentenced to 28 years for his role in a wide-ranging racketeering conspiracy that included fraud, extortion, and tax crimes. Kilpatrick extorted city vendors, rigged bids, and took kickbacks and bribes. He used funds from nonprofit civic organizations to line his pockets and those of his family, steering millions of dollars to himself and his friends as Detroit plunged deeper into poverty. Kilpatrick was released because Trump commuted his sentence in 2020. So, of course, now he's endorsed him. But it's weird, right? How many of the black men endorsing Trump are formerly prominent and famous black men who have criminal records? Not like the criminal records this country has racked up for black men through things like the war on drugs. Nope. For crimes they committed after they were prominent and or rich. Kind of like Donald Trump. Also on hand as part of Trump's Blacks for Trump coalition, black Republican Congressman John James, who represents an overwhelmingly white, affluent district in Macomb and Sterling Heights, Michigan, meaning not that district, whose congresswoman is Rashida Tlaib. Also, Detroit native and former Trump HUD secretary Dr. Ben Carson, who hasn't lived in Detroit since he was a child, and more recently has lived in mansions in places like Virginia and Florida. The ever-present Trump apologist Byron Donalds, whose majority white district is also in Florida, and a claque of local Detroit rappers who, apologies, I confess, I've never heard of. The church where Trump held this town hall is called 180 Church. The pastor, Lorenzo Sewell, is a Detroit native who grew up in an abusive home, with his father going to prison when he was a teenager. His experience with the criminal justice system did not happen when he was already rich and famous. He became a drug dealer and gang member as a troubled kid, the way it tragically happens for so many Americans in communities with high rates of poverty. But he had a conversion experience his senior year in high school in 1999, according to his church bio, and later became a pastor. Here he is, claiming Biden and Obama never visited the hood.
President Trump, I'm so humbled that you would be here. President Obama never came to the hood, so to speak, right? President Joe Biden, he went to the big NAACP dinner, but he never came to the hood. So thank you.
This is the part where I point out that President Obama came to Michigan 15 times as president, including Detroit. Pastor Sewell also claimed it's hard to find a black barber in Detroit for his Blasian kids, which honestly was weird. And in an interview on Fox after the roundtable, he quoted something you've probably never heard of called the Platinum Plan, a black wealth plan he claimed Donald Trump created, but which actually was the idea of rapper Ice Cube. So not a Trump plan at all. And I'll add this. It is ironic that Trump is attempting to court black voters in Detroit just 4 years after lying about black voters in Detroit and claiming their votes were inherently fraudulent. Michigan was one of the states whose votes Trump, Rudy Giuliani, and their little cabal tried to steal in their insurrection. The attorney general in Michigan has charged 16 people with felonies for trying to steal the votes of black Michiganders from Detroit.
These lights are so bright in my eyes that I can't see too many people out there. But I can only see the black ones. I can't see any white ones, you see. We've all seen the mugshot. And you know who embraced it more than anybody else? The black population. It's incredible. You see black people walking around with my mugshot. You know, they do shirts and they sell them for $19 a piece. It's pretty amazing.
I'll admit it makes me uncomfortable to play that. But because we're 5 months out from an election that's too close for comfort, people need to see him. Nobody says, nobody believes what he says to people who wants to vote for him. Because it's amazing that those words come out of the mouth of someone who was one of our two choices to be president of the United States in 2024. And of course, there's always more. Stop me if you heard someone accused of being a racist before saying this. He said he has many black friends. That's his defense when asked how he responds to black voters or others who call him a racist. This is what he told Semaphore in an interview out today. Quote, I have so many black friends that if I were a racist, they wouldn't be my friends. They would know better than anybody in FAST. We're back with the Rev and Andrew. Rev, I'll ask you two questions. One, how do we process this? And two, how do we cover this?
I think that we cover it by the record. I think that we should not bite the bait of having to prove Donald Trump is a racist. I think clearly I've known Donald Trump. I've marched on him, and then he tried to be friendly. He's come to my convention. I believe he's a racist, but that's not what we have to prove. Just look at his record. He is always race baited. He started with the Central Park Five innocent young men in New York. He called for the death penalty. Well, has he ever called for the death penalty for anybody else? His political career started by saying a black man was not a real American. He was born in Kenya. Birtherism. Has he questioned even Joe Biden's birthplace? I mean, everything about race, he's always race baited against blacks. So all you got to do is look at his record. And I've said to any of those that support him, show me where he was on the right side of any race issue. We forget. This is the man that said when we saw the march in Charlottesville, where they were saying things to protect a Confederate statue, Robert E. Lee. And saying anti-Semitic things. He said they're firing people on both sides. He was the president sitting in the White House, president, during George Floyd, probably the biggest race case of our time. What did he say about George Floyd? Oh, I'm sorry. He had them clear the protesters from in front of the church, held up a Bible, and condemned the protesters. Never even tried to say anything about police reform. So if the record is, Sotomayor said it about the other kid, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. I believe he's a racist, but you don't have to believe that. Just believe you're against one that's always on the wrong side of racial policies and racial legislation. And I don't believe everybody that votes for him is a racist, but I believe every racist votes for Donald Trump.
What do you make of their very deliberate, very public strategy to talk about really running up Trump's numbers amid black voters in 24?
I think the strategy is that he wants to, in a tight election, try to just get some more black votes or dissuade blacks from voting, and that he feels is enough to get him over the hump, which is why I think that the Biden people have to really invest in a counter argument, because you can't take that for granted. And, you know, now he's going to a black church in Detroit. He went to the Bronx. And if you notice the crowd in the Bronx, he imported a crowd. He could even import a lot of blacks, and only blacks he put on stage was two indicted rappers. I mean, which, you know, he probably should get lessons from them on how to handle that. But for him to say, when we've spent generations telling our kids, this is Father's Day Sunday, to do the right thing, follow the law, do what is right. For him to say that we are in some way synonymous with mugshots, he didn't say some blacks. He said the black population identified with it, because that's who we are, criminals, thugs. That's what he thinks of us. For him to say that, imagine if Barack Obama had said that about whites. Imagine if anybody had said that about any other race, but he gets away with it in the name of he has swagger. I think he gets away with it because we're not calling it straight out what it is. This is not even dog whistling. This is straight out saying I'm playing to racism. And Donald Trump has done that when he got away with birtherism, where people wouldn't call it what it was, because all that was saying he's not one of us. When he got away with that, he takes the next step. He takes the next step. One thing you've seen in his trials, Nicole, when we've seen it in civil court now, he's gone through two or three there, and Andrew's gone through the criminal trial. You've not seen one black business person come into court and accuse him of giving them a deal. Not one. How do you be in business 40 years in New York, which is two-thirds black and Latino, and everybody you did business with was white?
It's hard.
Unless you are clearly not one that wants to deal with diversity and how you do your business.
It's an important conversation. We got to keep an eye on it. Thank you.
Native Land Pod is a production of iHeartRadio in partnership with Reason Choice Media.
Welcome, 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 welcome.
Hey everyone, this is a very special Father's Day edition of our mini pod, and we want to welcome you home, especially to the fathers. Andrew has some big thoughts on what it means to be a black father in this country. And so, Andrew, I want you to take it away.
Thank you, sis. The reputation of black fathers has weathered the bumps, bruises, and pains of not only the impacts of the actual job of being a father, but also the mercilessly relentless media and societal narratives that are often critical, such words as deadbeat, useless, absent, uncaring, and not a family person are just some of the words, phrases, descriptions that might accompany the misguided definition of a father. Nothing, however, could be further from the truth. As we approach this Father's Day, let's use our energy to tell a more complete and honest story of black men who are also fathers. But before we deepen into this mini pod with me and my co-host, I have a very, very simple request for our listeners. And that is, could you please take 60 seconds, 1 minute to reflect on your experience with your own father? It could be a precious memory that encapsulates in some short form, the best memory you have of your father, living or past. Maybe you could even offer what your father may have offered you by way of the best advice that you didn't know was at the point, but you by and by came to learn and benefit from. And this is actually where I'd like to begin the conversation with my co-host, which is, I know we each have different experiences with father and father figures in our lives. And I certainly don't expect any of us to romanticize any part of it, but to hopefully talk honestly about what it means. But this was really Tiffany's idea to sort of deepen into this conversation about fathers and black men as fathers. And then I saw it on our database and I was like, I want to borrow this from you, because I kept thinking, just as Mother's Day had recently passed, about how just how in every single way it seems society reemphasizes and defines and glorifies the role of the mother, which I think is awesome, amazing. And I do the same thing for my own and for my children's mother, my wife. But I often, you know, sort of struggle with the fact that the role of the black male father is not as well extolled, is not as celebrated. And in so many ways, it's the exact opposite. It's given a reputation, a brand, and it's our fight to struggle to come from underneath that brand. Mm-hmm. And if you do rise from underneath it, you're an exception, a very rare exception. And I think all of us know that that isn't the total and complete truth. So my question to y'all is, if you could offer a memory, a thought, maybe a piece of advice that sort of sticks with you when you think about your relationship to your own dad?
The first thing that came to mind when you were talking about a memory is my dad used to take me and my cousins to feed the ducks, which we can't do anymore in Seattle. But I love that. What I know is that my dad is a constant presence. And I know that that is an exception and not the norm. Not just for, I think, for black fathers, but I think for so many kids and their fathers, even if they grew up in the house with them, like there's a label put on them of like, you're the provider. And correct. So that means you work your hands to the bone to provide. Right. And that means also that you can't be there with your kids as much. But I feel really fortunate, spoiled, and privileged to have grown up with a dad who was always there. And if he wasn't doing something for fun with me, we were definitely on our way to a protest. So that's the memory they come to play.
I love that.
We love Papa Rye.
Yeah, we
shout
do.
Out to Papa Rye. So my dad passed away when I was 12, I think. But my father, I was a daddy's girl all day. Mm-hmm. He, too, was a constant presence. We didn't live in the same house. He and my mom were together long enough to create me, and that was it. Right. But my father spent the night at our house, slept on the couch every Christmas Eve to be there with me when I would open my toys in the morning. If I wanted to be with my father, I was with my father. Now, that meant wherever my father was, I was there. If it was at a cabaret at midnight and I wanted to be with him, I was there. And he used to work for the city, driving like the big like machines that paved the roads. Mm-hmm. And he would drive by to see me. He had a motorcycle. I would be on, this is the 80s. So yeah. Kid rules were different. I'd be on the motorcycle with him. One of my earliest memories, and I think it's important to say this to reflect the genuine love of all fathers. Mm-hmm. My dad struggled with addiction and he would have me with him, and he was everybody, kind to everyone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He just never met a stranger. He loved animals. He was kind to people. And if you were like the winos on the corner, my dad would spend his last dollar to get them a fifth or whatever. And I remember, because I could be with him wherever, one of my earliest memories, I was a little girl, maybe 3 or 4. And I was on his lap and my dad was with his friends doing what they do.
Yeah.
And it was a bunch of guys and they were like, Bronco, like Bronson Reed was my father's name. Bronco, put your daughter to bed. And my father has some choice words. My daughter can sit up here all day if she want to on my lap. It's like midnight. And he said, man, please, my daughter going to be cool. She going to know about all this. And they start rolling the weed. My daughter's like, watch this, baby. What's this? I was like, a joint? See, ain't nobody going to be able to talk no shit to my daughter. See,
oh, blah, my blah, blah.
But he was an amazing dad.
Yeah.
You know, like I don't romanticize what it would have been like to have Dr. Huxtable and Claire as my parents. I think the parents I had well prepared me for this life. And made me relatable to people beyond a socioeconomic status. You can drop me off in the hood on any MLK Boulevard and I'm comfortable, I'm at home.
That's real.
And I credit my father in large part to that.
Yeah, it's funny you describe your dad as sort of gregarious, outgoing, didn't meet a stranger.
Yeah.
My dad was the same way and also struggled with addiction, alcohol addiction in his case. And I remember, it feels like all of it so vividly because, so my dad was a construction worker growing up and my mom drove school buses. And there were seven of us, you know, seven kids. And my dad would, I quite frankly remember my dad being more at my school plays, track meets, school events, even more than my mom. And that's not to say one is better than the other. My mother oftentimes couldn't do it because she would pick up after driving the school bus and she worked down the street at the dry cleaners where she would press clothes until it closed. Mm. And then on the weekends, she would clean houses and we would often go with her. So she was often, you know, out there making sure that we had, you know, she was earning what she needed to take care of all of us. But my father would like be the funnest guy in the room. He cracked the jokes. He's, you know, slapping it, you know, on the back with everybody. And people just loved him. They gravitated to him. I certainly gravitated to him in that way. And then there was this point at which you would start to like, you know, get a little nervous because you knew daddy was drinking. And now at this point, you know, he'll go beyond that point. And then it turned, you know, ugly. Mm-hmm. And mostly it would turn ugly for my mother. And I remember not being able to reconcile the two. Like just being, is my dad a bad guy or a good mm-hmm. guy? Because I was experiencing him so much as a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd see him argue with my mother or I'd see him drunk and then pass out
mm-hmm.
and, you know, not have his, you know, his wits about him or whatever. But he was such a constant presence even through all of it, which mm-hmm. is so strange because you think of alcoholism and you think of alcohol abuse and you think about homes that seem or feel broken. And it's easy to put that parent in a box and you know which one is the bad one and which one is the good one and which one take care of you. And I don't have that of him. And I should also note today that we are sitting down and speaking is my dad's birthday. He passed away the year after I ran for governor, a few months after the race for governor was over. And I remember feeling like not the good child because I didn't know he was sick. He didn't share it. It was such a shock, you know, such a surprise. You know, the next time I see him is at a hospital and he's not speaking. And, you know, a few days later, you know, dad's gone. And but it is also very much so him.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't tell his problems to anybody. He didn't lean on anybody. Yeah. He didn't want to be a burden to anybody. If something was wrong, he just held it. He just kept it. So I'm thinking about my dad being deployed by the campaign, going to these neighborhoods,
mm-hmm.
going back to Miami, like mm-hmm. just doing what he could for his son while in pain and not mm-hmm. sharing it. And, you know, some, you know, guilt around that, right?
Yeah, of course, of course.
Targaryens are gone.
Burn them all!
Not all of them.
But I think part of what makes the job of Black fathers particularly challenging is not only do you have filling the role,
mm-hmm.
right? You got to show up. You're often the provider, right?
Mm-hmm.
People who even grow up with dads in the home, as you referenced, Angela, you know, they may be in the home, but they're also working this, you know, the society gives them a burden that they have to cure. So he did those things, but I think as I reflect on him, I'm so blessed
mm-hmm.
for the nuggets. You know, he would tell every one of my other siblings, watch out for this one because God knows he don't have it in common sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he thought I was the kid that everybody was going to get over on because I saw innocence.
The diplomat.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was like innocence and everything. And daddy's like, nah, son, you know. So he's telling my little baby sister, watch out for your brother.
Yeah.
Like, that's not mm-hmm. the way they're supposed to go.
And Monique does.
Yeah,
to be
she
fair.
Does. Yeah, she's a lawyer and she's skeptical of everybody and everything.
Yeah.
But I think about the role that we have to play and then layer on top of that what society then says you are.
Yeah.
In every single way, shape, and form.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, particularly for you, Angela, because you do sit at an interesting intersection with Hollywood, film, production, the portrayal of figures
mm-hmm.
In our community is like, is it that saleable to tell the story repeatedly of an absentee dad who ain't about shit versus a more complete and accomplished story?
Yeah. You know, I have a unique, I think, bias here. And I think part of it is I really do believe that a lot of people make film, write screenplays and all of that based on their own experiences. Yeah. Like people pile, I feel like, often on Tyler Perry. And I don't really see it in the same way. He has been relentless about speaking his truth about his experience.
Absolutely.
Growing up around his mom, when he went into the shop with her, like he talks about his own experience. And so you can get mad at it, but really, what is the societal condition that is there for us to address? I do think we could spend a lot more time highlighting not just the Black father, but also Black families and the ways, especially now, that people come together alternatively to create loving environments. I think one of the dopest things about the Black community historically has been our village. Yeah. You know, the mentality that it takes a village to raise a child, and sometimes your aunties and your cousins and all that ain't blood related. Mm-hmm. But we were there because as a protection mechanism. And that is deep love that has virtually been destroyed now by this is so not the point of this particular podcast, but like by gentrification and housing affordability and access and all of that. Some of those things have been broken down, and it has been very detrimental to, I think, these kids.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that where fathers had to work, you know, auntie so-and-so came in and took over, this grandma or this nana came in. And I think that some of those things should be celebrated more than what the father didn't do. The fact that this kid ended up all right is a testament to how incredibly dope and versatile and innovative the Black community is.
I think we should do a mini pod on Tyler Perry. Maybe something like how Black art and like storytellers. But I just want to offer this, and I did not plan this for this particular episode, but I just wrote something on Black fathers, and so I had to do research on it. And 70% of Black fathers who live with their children were most likely to have bathed, dressed, changed, or helped their babies potty every day. So even this narrative of Black fathers aren't there is not true. The data doesn't support it. And that was according to the CDC, the Center for Disease Control. Mm-hmm. The data showed that that was even more than white fathers. They were at 60%. Mm-hmm. Latino fathers were at 45%. Those same Black fathers were also more likely to have eaten a meal with their children. Mm-hmm. And the numbers are high, not just for biological fathers living in the home, but also for Black fathers stepping into the role of a step parent. Mm-hmm. And it shows that Black fathers maintain consistent involvement with their children, even when outside the home.
That's real.
I hate to say this. I may lose a man corner here or two in the audience. But I have to say President Obama was also somebody who perpetuated a narrative of this absent Black father that was not true. He represented a Black father who was present. Mm-hmm. But in his remarks, he would make these comments. And it's like, what are you basing that on?
Correct.
That's not true. His Black father was not present. And so to your point, maybe he was talking about
his own experience. Yeah.
But then would carry that message. And as the president, when you're speaking, you're not speaking to your father, you're speaking to the
everybody's
world. Yeah. And so the world would hear you lecture on some level.
Yeah.
Black
yeah.
fathers. Yeah. And it wasn't warranted. It's like, hey, these kids go to Sidwell with your kids.
Yeah.
You know, like these kids' fathers are doing the same thing you're doing.
And he could have also been a victim of what society reemphasizes about who we are and how we show up.
Who they expected him to be.
That's right.
So he wanted to say, no, I'm on some level, I'm one of the good ones.
Except
look at me, and I'm
going
to go talk
Michelle
to them
Obama's
and tell them.
Book and you hear another expression.
Well, she was very honest about how things worked in their home and being challenged for a good decade in their marriage.
Absolutely.
Because of those roles and responsibilities.
And I get that too, right? Because he has... He had expectations put on him of how he was supposed to perform. I always find it interesting when people think of dads as like disassociated emotionally from, you know, their kids. I mean, I know Black dads who did skin to skin immediately after the mother did skin to skin contact with the baby after the baby was born, who were the ones who got up. I did, of course. Yeah,
with
all three.
Really?
For sure.
How'd you do it with both the twins? Did you do it one by one? I had a broad chest. Really?
No, and
so
I did,
you did it at the same time with
both of
them?
Of course.
They were premature and they were tiny.
And they're, you know, they're everything. I take great pride in the role I'm able to play with my kids today. And it wasn't always that way. Mm-hmm. I think about, you know, when I was still very heavily entrenched in politics. And there were others in addition to RJ, but my mother-in-law, you know, sitters who would have to take on more of those present roles. And I think I remember reflecting, like, after I lost the race, I kept thinking, like, oh my gosh, all these years that I can never get back, I gave to this thing, and I'll never. And it's okay, and I'm okay with it now because there are new moments that we're able to create. I love being emotionally in tune with them. I want my kids, you know, to talk to me. I want my little third one to talk less because he just tells it all.
Boss baby don't play.
But we show up and we grieve and we have, you know, just deep hopes. And I think some of what I always try to figure out, like my dad would always couch a good moment with, like, you know, the shoes can drop. The shoe's gonna drop tomorrow. Like, he would never let you get too high on the on the upswing because he was trying to prepare me for the disappointing moments and days. And I know a lot of dads who do that. You want to tell your kid there's something around the bend. Like, be happy about this thing. Be okay. But they didn't let us go overboard because they knew that there was a much crueler and tougher society out there, conditions that they could not control, that they didn't want us to be thrown completely off and just set back on our heels. They're trying to prepare us.
I struggle now with
a different preparation for my children because I don't want them to, you know, to think that everything's hunky-dory in the world and everybody wishes them well and that kind of thing. But also don't want them having, you know, seeing everything through a negative frame.
It's a unique burden that Black fathers have because it's like your mind. And I think this is unique to Black children. They come in the world as ours in terms of the communities.
That's right.
If you see any Black child anywhere, you feel responsible
for
that
child. Watch out, baby. Don't get too close to the, you know, whatever
that is. This woman, I don't remember who she was.
I'd be yelling at people's kids out the car. Yeah. I used to make fun of my dad.
Angela cares for you all the way through.
Tiffany,
be careful. There's a swinging thing up there coming off the side of the building.
My dad would say, she alive, ain't she?
These children, I think because of the trauma of the plantation, that they could be beaten or taken away from you or looked at as an adult at a certain point when they were far too young, that you do feel this traumatic protection for Black children. And you feel licensed to intervene. So if you see a father walking with his kids and you don't know this man from Adam, I feel like a lot of Black women take license like those are my children babies. To say something if I want to. You can say to this father, that baby need a jacket on. Or that child need a hat on his head. And Black men seem to understand this. You know, it might be frustrating and annoying, but it's like, this is how it works. At the playground, my friends have kids. One of my close friends, he has three kids. I went to the playground with him, and it's a smorgasbord of kids there. But the Black kids, all the Black parents responsible for the Black kids.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't say anything to the white kids because you never know
how the parenting is.
But if you're in my community, I know. It's like, hey, I told him to get down. He was crawling up
that
thing.
It's
a collective raising of our children.
Right.
But can I just say this too really quickly about your dad, Andrew? I hear you about like being in pain. I think that is quintessential Black men. My father, I didn't know, he ended up passing away from cirrhosis of the liver. My grandfather was like that. Something about Black men where it's like, we don't, of our generation and before, where you don't get to wear your feelings. And also, I would bet, I didn't know your dad, but I know your dad.
Yeah.
And I would bet he would not change any amount of time he spent. No way was he going to be at home feeling pain. I got to go hit this pavement. That's what I know how to do.
This
is my boy. You know, my boy is running for governor. I'm going to go out and do this because this makes me not think about the pain. It not makes me think about my illness, you know?
He was so proud.
Yes.
So I want you to, like, you're talking about guilt. Like,
don't,
Andrew,
he was doing what
so
he wanted to
proud.
Do. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, I know there are more proud ones out there just like him. Mm-hmm. We're running short on time, but I hope that on this Father's Day that we do collectively, individually, and everywhere we can celebrate, lift up, compliment, share an experience that alters other people's narrative about what they think we are and how we show up, not necessarily just for them, but for us.
Yeah.
It pains me when I see impressions of Black men as fathers that are wayward and don't reflect the men that I know.
Yeah.
And so this isn't about scripting to other people so that they understand and appreciate us. It's a script to ourselves, a reminder to ourselves, the ways in which we are pretty incredible beings, despite what they want us to believe about us.
Mm-hmm.
I want to thank
you. And you are, can we just say real quickly to our resident father, you yes. are a wonderful Black dad. Angela has spent a lot more time with Andrew and the kids. We went to brunch
the other week.
A couple weeks ago. And Andrew, I mean, three kids. You don't get to enjoy anything
of yours.
Yeah, Andrew would be ready to go put a scoop of ice cream, and it was like they would descend.
They converge.
And the ice cream
everything,
was gone.
Everything.
Angela, I'm getting my own pancakes. They would descend, I'm and his pancakes you, are gone. They were just like devouring everything.
I was telling Tiff how I used to have to go into the pantry.
Yes.
If I want something for myself, I have to go into the pantry, sit down, and put my foot up against the
literally
door.
Literally keeping the
so
door
they can't
locked
open
so
it.
He can
yes,
eat,
I can eat it.
So he can have his own food.
Whatever you have is theirs. I love them for it.
Hanging off
God
you. Like, he couldn't even sit him. There. Yeah. Like, David had his hand wrapped around. Even when you could eat, you were being choked. And, I mean, if you standing up, one hanging off your arm. But those kids adore
they
you.
They love him.
It is a beautiful thing to see your kids the way they love you and to hear you tell your story. And I think, what stories might your children tell about you one day? And I have no doubt they will all be joyful and be told about it. So happy
that.
Father's Day
happy
to you.
Thank you.
Father's
and
day,
happy
Andrew
Father's
Gillum.
Day out there to all of you. And welcome home.
Welcome home. All right, thanks for listening, you guys. Please, please, please remember to rate, review, subscribe, and tune into our regular episode on Thursdays. Welcome.
In 1921, a mob of white Americans ravished a prospering Black neighborhood in Oklahoma, decimating hundreds of businesses and thousands of homes, what would become known as the Tulsa Race Massacre.
And at the time, there were only 36 deaths reported. But many historians believe there were hundreds of people killed during the massacre. And as a native of Tulsa, sharing the resiliency of my community has always been important to me. So I took a trip back home and sat down with descendants and one of the last survivors of the massacre to see how the city's next generation is rebuilding.
This is Black Wall Street, part of the Greenwood District here in my hometown of Tulsa. And although many know it from its dark history, residents and descendants wanted to be known for what it truly is, a place of resilience, hope, and Black excellence.
At the University of Tulsa, I sat down with professor and archaeologist Dr. Alicia Oduwale, who's leading a research project to dig up more of Greenwood's past.
So as an archaeologist, what exactly is it that you do?
My day-to-day life is more about working with my community. We do a lot of mapping and archival research before we ever go out and dig anything.
What have you uncovered so far?
We found bullets and barbed wire next to doll parts, next to wind-up toys, next to marbles. For a lot of people, they think of the Tulsa Race Massacre as something that is just a war among men. They tried to wipe out families and children.
There are stories in here about machine guns being perched on Standpipe Hill, shooting into the crowd, so we can actually follow up on archaeologically and see if there are any archaeological evidence that connect to these stories.
And barbed wire, where someone could have been tied up, or?
These are narratives that are coming out, bearing witness to people being actually wrapped with barbed wire and then dragged through the streets. That's part of the story.
As part of the massacre?
Yeah. The artifacts are bearing witness to things that we don't have in our history books. And, you know, Greenwood never left.
Greenwood never left.
Yeah.
At the Greenwood Cultural Center, I met up with my former schoolmate, Dr. Tiffany Crutcher, who was thrust into social activism following the 2016 police killing of her brother, Terrence Crutcher.
What is your mission right now?
In the center of our work is honoring the legacy of our ancestors and make sure that future generations never forget this story and that they learn about the story. We believe that we can rebuild Black Wall Street.
What keeps you going?
Racial healing is simply acknowledging truth. And I believe that Tulsa is the microcosm of what's happening across this entire nation. These survivors are holding on. I traveled with them to Congress, and they sat there saying, we believe we deserve justice. We still believe in America, even though they've been through the worst times.
And for my last stop,
knock, 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 knock,
a visit to Mother Randall.
Look at this superstar right here. How are you, Mother Randall?
Oh, I'm fine.
Good to see you. I wanted to bring you some flowers.
Oh, thank you so much.
With the recent passing of Hughes Van Ellis, she's one of the last two Tulsa Race Massacre survivors left.
You have to feel amazing that this is your legacy right here. What are some of the stories that she's told you over the years?
Some of the things that Grandma has seen and experienced, she doesn't want to talk about because it's like she relives it all over again.
After years of seeking reparations for that trauma, an Oklahoma judge dismissed the survivor's lawsuit in July, but an appeal has since been made.
Knowing that, you know, the lawsuit was dismissed, that hurt all of us. But I told her we're not going anywhere. We want to leave a legacy for her to build up North Tulsa, build it up back the way it used to be.
And is this you right here too?
I don't know who that girl is.
That's you.
I was the girl in those days.
So your birthday is coming up. 109 years old. You got a birthday wish?
I would like to see all of my people here trying to make this situation better, to bring some of those things to life so people will know that it really is true. There's room for a lot more improvement.
She needs to see justice in this lifetime. So does Mother Fletcher. That's what they need to see in this lifetime while they're still alive.
And time is running out there, but it was an emotional trip back home for me because growing up, we didn't talk about the Tulsa Race Massacre. I didn't know anything about it until I went off to Jackson State and I had a professor who said, "You're from Black Wall Street." And that was the same story for my schoolmate, Dr. Tiffany Crutcher. She didn't know until she went off to school in Alabama. So it's kind of nice to go home, but to keep this story alive and show the resiliency of that community is what's important.
And to see what you and your schoolmate are doing to make sure people know about it.
Yeah.
Well done.
Thank you.
We've said it before, and we're probably going to have to say it again. The Supreme Court's got to go. Yeah, we was hyped to finally get a black lady on the court, but to give sisters in there windmilling by her damn against a court stacked with conservative and miserable motherfuckers and state Supreme Courts loaded with less notable conservative and miserable motherfuckers who barely allow the cases that need to be seen get a chance to be seen. Because how miserable do you have to be to dismiss a case that would award damages to the remaining survivors of the Tulsa Race Massacre? It's only two of them. If you don't know, the Tulsa Race Massacre befell the neighborhood of Greenwood, Tulsa in 1921. It's also known as the Burning of Black Wall Street, but that's not enough to describe what took place one faithful Memorial Day weekend in 1921. Here's what happened. A 19-year-old black shoe shiner, Dick Rowland, allegedly attacked a 17-year-old white elevator operator by the name of Sarah Page. Shortly after Rowland was arrested, local newspapers began to publish inflammatory articles exaggerating the details of the incident, spreading the word that a lynching may be afoot. Dog whistles for the white people already looking for a problem with the flourishing black neighborhood teeming with black businesses, several black millionaires by today's standards, and hundreds of black middle-class families. However, many of these black residents were also World War I vets. So these self-appointed guardians said, "Not today, Satan," pulled up to the courthouse with a sealant missing, armed to protect Rowland's right to a fair trial. And of course, they were met with an angry and armed white mob, and shots were fired. Chaos ensued, and for the next 24 hours, the district of Greenwood was effectively demolished. Innocent men, women, and children were slain in the streets, resulting in an unknown number of black deaths. But according to Tulsa's own history museum, in the wake of the violence, 35 city blocks lay charred in ruins. More than 800 people were treated for injuries, and historians now believe that as many as 300 people may have died. Moreover, this all took place on their baby's prom night. Now, justice for this night has been a century-long battle for those two remaining survivors, Viola Fletcher and Leslie Benningfield Randall, both 110 and 109 years old, respectively. And y'all ain't even got no respect for your elders? The original lawsuit filed in 2021 claims that the city of Tulsa broke the public nuisance law when it failed to respond to the Greenwood District of Tulsa in its time of need. And on top of that, the city is now profiting off of the tragedy by positioning the area as a tourist destination in the city. What? The lawsuit was also originally filed with Viola's little brother, Hughes Van Ellis, but he passed last year at the age of 102. Now, it's all already terrible, but get this. The case was first dismissed by an Oklahoma district court judge on the basis that simply being connected to a historical event does not provide a person with unlimited rights to seek compensation. So what does? And I'm not asking for unlimited rights. I'm asking for my rights. Like, what does unlimited rights even mean? Do you mean that black people shouldn't have the audacity to access the full realizations of their rights? Because that's what it sounds like to me, sister. Anyway, this is where it gets a little granular, but follow me. A dismissal from a district court judge means you can never file again in the state district court, which is why they then went to appeal to the Oklahoma Supreme Court. But yesterday, the Oklahoma Supreme Court said, with respect to the public nuisance claim, though the plaintiff's grievances are legitimate, they do not fall within the scope of our state's public nuisance statute. And this is what I mean. The current structures do not serve us. Could they be absolutely correct in saying that this claim falls outside the public nuisance statute? No shit, Sherlock. It happened 100 years ago. But it took 100 years for these individuals, systems, structures, and the community surrounding them to evolve enough to bring the case to court. And saying that being connected to a historical event doesn't give a person right to seek compensation is this is the policy-ass way of saying we would never in our lives give all of you N-words reparations. Because hold on now. Japanese Americans got reparations for them internment camps. 120,000 of them to be exact, about 45 years after the fact. In addition, Memphis people even got something. A slap in the face, sure, because it only amounted to about $1,000 per person. But in 1946, Congress awarded about $1.3 billion to 176 tribes and bands. The men violated in the Tuskegee syphilis experiments got about $10 million, among other things. And on the topic of city massacres specifically, Rosewood survivors got $2.1 million, and Chicago gave $5.5 million to victims of police brutality in the 1970s and 80s. But the most infamous of all, y'all want to be stingy? And these women are 100+. They literally only have so much fight left in them, but still, they're not playing. Last year, Viola and Hughes gave testimony for a House committee considering their reparations. And Viola said she still sees black men being shot, black bodies lying in the streets, still smells smoke and sees fire, still sees black businesses being burned, still hears airplanes flying overhead, and that she still hears the screams. And she's not even talking about the consistency of these acts over the 100 years since the massacre. She's still talking about the night of. My God, today. Ellis said because of the massacre, his family was driven from their home. They were left with nothing, and they were made refugees in their own country. They were shown that not all men are created equal under law, that when black voices call out for justice, no one cared, that he himself fought for freedom abroad, even though it was ripped away from him at home. We cannot make this shit up unless we forget all of this over a claim that we know to be a lie, that a black boy brought harm to a white girl. And one of the highest courts of the land is going to let that slide. But did you know that you could vote for them too? I know. Lene, my vote don't matter. Shut the fuck up. Yes, it do. With all the slimy and sneaky ass voter suppression laws being passed, they see you becoming more and more aware of your power, and they are trying to take it away from you. I promise they would not go through these things to take it if it was not that effective. Supreme Court justices are either elected or appointed by a governor depending on what state you're in, and it's about a 50-50 split. So you can either vote for them directly, or you can vote for a progressive governor that will make an appointment in the interest of the people. State Supreme Courts are just as important to think about as your president, because they are the ones who have the power to determine what your state does in the wake of all of these big decisions. Like the reversal of Roe v. Wade, the threats to affirmative action, the few civil rights court decisions you did learn about in grade school. In order for the world to be a better place, there's got to be good people in high places. So what are you going to do to ensure that they get there?
Well, last year, President Biden made Juneteenth the newest federal holiday. June 19th marks the date in 1865 when the last enslaved people in America found out that they were free. CBS News special correspondent James Brown spoke with renowned Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. about the history and the significance of Juneteenth.
Juneteenth was not embraced as a national black holiday for a long, long time, but it was kept alive by black people in Texas. And that's what's so sweet about it. Our people have been hungry for holidays, hungry for tradition, hungry for stories about black history.
Because
without a past, you have no future. Did you like Harvard?
Perhaps no one has done more to inform Americans of their past and in turn their future than Henry Louis Gates Jr. By day, he is a professor and director of the Hutchins Center for African and African American Research at Harvard.
I'm Henry Louis Gates Jr. Welcome to Finding Your Roots.
By night, he is the host and producer of the PBS genealogy show Finding Your Roots, as well as countless documentaries on black history.
These are the big three in the history of freedom of our enslaved ancestors. The Emancipation Proclamation, signed on January 1st, 1863, Juneteenth, June 19th, 1865, and then finally the ratification of the 13th Amendment on December 6, 1865, which is what finally and ultimately abolished the institution of slavery.
Why do you think that June 19th stuck?
One of the reasons that I think Juneteenth stuck is that we're all charmed by the poetic brilliance of the name, Juneteenth. What better name for a June 19th could there possibly be? That's great. It's fetching. You know, it's catchy.
As with all catchy names, Gates says there is also a bit of fiction around that day in 1865 when Gordon Granger issued General Order No. 3 to free the enslaved black people of Galveston, Texas, 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation.
Well, we were raised to think that Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, right? The problem is that the Emancipation Proclamation in and of itself didn't have the power to free anybody. It only applied to enslaved people in the Confederacy, and it can only be enforced if Union troops had captured territory in the South, in the Confederacy. Only about 500,000 enslaved men and women, we think, actually got their freedom from the Emancipation Proclamation. And James, there were 3.9 million enslaved African Americans, so the overwhelming majority of our ancestors were not freed by the Emancipation Proclamation.
So the significance then of General Gordon Granger going to Galveston?
We all think that the Civil War ended when Lee surrendered to Grant at Appomattox, which was April 9, 1865. But that's not true. There were several different Confederate armies. So Texas finally surrenders to the Union on June 2nd. Gordon Granger comes, and on June 19th in Galveston, he issues the Emancipation Proclamation because now the Union Army is in possession of the territory. So that's the true story.
And what about the notion that enslaved black people in Texas did not know they were free?
One of the myths about Juneteenth is that nobody in Texas had heard about it. But there are two reasons that many historians think that black people knew about the Emancipation Proclamation, too. One is because of the proverbial grapevine. So there was this miraculous way for enslaved people to communicate plantation to plantation and state to state. But the second factor is that because Texas was removed from the main action of the Civil War, many slaveholders moved to Texas for safety, and they took their enslaved people with them. Those enslaved people would have known about the Emancipation Proclamation by and large and would have told other enslaved people. But no one could enforce it because the Union did not capture territory then.
When I came here, I dedicated this tree in honor of my mother and father.
Professor Gates says the most important thing about Juneteenth is the era that came after.
The most radical thing that happened after the end of the Civil War for the rights of our enslaved ancestors were the ratification of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments and the Reconstruction Acts. This was the first concentration of black power. In the summer of 1867, 80% of all eligible black men who were formerly enslaved in the South registered to vote. And in 1868, they actually voted. Ulysses S. Grant won the presidency. So you could reasonably say that black men had elected a president of the United States.
Back in Galveston, Texas, the formerly enslaved began marking their freedom with a celebration 1 year later in 1866 and have been celebrating Juneteenth ever since. As far as Professor Gates is concerned, the details of Juneteenth are less important than the power of its message.
There's a kind of poetic magic in that story, a kind of comfort, a kind of retribution, a kind of belated administering of justice that appeals to all of us. Juneteenth is one of the first holidays that black people created on their own. And of the holidays that they created in slavery times, Juneteenth is the one that survived and is now a national holiday.
Isn't it important for all Americans to understand that Juneteenth ought to be embraced by all Americans?
For a country built upon the love of freedom, any manifestation of the enjoyment of freedom should be celebrated by all our countrymen. Let's hope for that day.
In Cambridge, Massachusetts, James Brown, CBS News.
Thanks for listening. Peace.
The sun's shining, birds are singing, and all feels right in the world.
Until the season changes, and suddenly you lose your motivation to get out of bed. In fact, 1 in 5 people experience some form of depression, no matter the season or time of year.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, our vision is to build a mentally healthy nation for all, because we want you to live your best life and be your best you all year round.
Please visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
I've got a message, message. 나 지금 심심해, 난 말이